Hey, welcome to a very special edition of the Life 2.0 podcast. I'm John St. Augustine. Time to go up the down staircase in the outdoor, make sense out of the senseless, if at all possible, find the obvious, bear to the absurd, hold on to your lug nuts. Time for an overall. So we are convening here on a Wednesday, and it's not exactly a Wednesday rant, even though I have some of that in mind, but today is the day that we celebrate Dr. Jane Goodall's 90th birthday. And when I think of the true forces of nature that show up in human form, Dr. Jane's got to be at the top of the frickin' list. I mean, since 1960, she's been working and bringing us information about chimpanzees and species, and you name it, she has done it. And I was working on a different project this morning. I was not planning on doing this whatsoever, by the way. And I found out today was her birthday, and I thought, oh, God, you know. And sometimes I think when people, at least for me, when people are doing their great work in the world, I tend to forget that they're doing their great work in the world. They're just doing their job. So the Jane Goodalls of the world are going about their business every day, bringing information to people that need it, and bringing inspiration to people that need it, and speaking on behalf of those who are often not heard from, which are the animals and the four-leggeds and the winged and the fish and all the rest that we share this planet with. And so today, to mark the occasion for her birthday, Mercy for Animals and the Jane Goodall Institute, the conservation organization founded by Dr. Jane, create a short film titled Voices of Hope, Words of Wisdom by Dr. Jane Goodall. And you can go to those websites, the Goodall Institute or Mercy for Animals online, and watch this video. And I clipped through it a little bit, and I started thinking about what it takes for somebody to be as unwavering in their commitment to something bigger than themselves that Dr. Jane does and has done for so many decades, in face of adversity, in face of loss, every kind of challenge you can imagine. She's gone through it and has emerged at this time and over time as this incredible voice of hope and the urgency to stay connected to and realize our connection to the natural world. I think in the beginning it was more about obviously the study of chimpanzees, but her message has gotten broader and deeper as the challenges that we face as a species have done the same. So I've had a couple of conversations with Dr. Jane over the years, and if you could dig into my audio vault, it is considerable and deep, which means finding stuff isn't always easy. You'd think I'd label it in a way that it was like alphabetical. Well, that doesn't work out that way. A lot of times, for example, it'll say, like today is Wednesday Rant Goodall, and I got to go find it somewhere. But anyway, I did find 20 minutes of a conversation we had a couple years ago, maybe 3 years ago now. Dr. Jane was in Chicago, and she invited me to come down and see her and meet with her. It was a Friday. I didn't get the email on time, and there was no way, and you know what, I was going downtown on a Friday in Chicago, even to meet Dr. Jane. I wouldn't have been on there, made it on time anyway. So we next best thing, I had to pull out the trusty, dusty Zoom machine, and the Zoom machine is different than the Zoom that you might think about with his video. This is a little tiny handheld deal that I can plug phones in and stuff like that. It's kind of a little mini robot. And the sound quality is not the greatest, but the message is definitely there. So I thought, in honor of her 90th birthday, I would grab this clip and jump in on a Wednesday and share this with you and share her with the world as she has for so long on my platform. I'm a huge fan. She inspires me to remind myself that there's more that I can do. I think about this so often, I can't even begin to tell you. You know, I have this microphone, and the fact that people around the world listen fascinates me, but I take great responsibility with that. You know, it's what Mr. Rogers said in regards to television. He said that the space between the host and the viewer is sacred and should be treated as such. I don't think that's in place very much anymore, but I do the same thing with this microphone. I don't know who's listening or where. I don't know what situations you're in or not. I don't know what your political leanings are. Quite frankly, I don't care. There's so much more to think about than our politics. I think the least effective way to describe somebody is how they vote. I mean, come on. And as I've said many, many times, there are no Democrat, Republican, or headstones that I've ever seen in any cemetery in all the years I've been going to funerals and burials. So if it's not that important then, why do we make it such a divisive and dividing factor now? Not quite sure about that, except on both sides of the fence, there's a lot to be gained if they grab your vote. But beyond all that, when you take the long view and you know go look at the moonrise that was taken back in the 60s, the great picture of Earth from the lunar surface, we're just a speck floating around in a lot of other little specks in a vast universe. And the fact that there is no other place to go, that this is our only home for sure, we shouldn't be screwing around with the things that keep our life support going. Most of the endangered species and things like that, to me, are canaries in the cave, or in the mine, I should say. It's, you know, back in the day, they'd put a canary into a mine shaft, and if the canary died, the men didn't go in. So when things are dying on our watch, we need to pay attention to that. And while I said before, Dr. Jane's work really started with chimpanzees, it has become so much bigger and broader than that about the big picture. And I get it. Look, I've been doing this work not nearly as long as she has, maybe 30 years. So I got a ways to go before I catch up, but I've never understood why you mess with your life support system. It just doesn't make any sense. We're the only species on the planet that does this intentionally on top of it. So in April, a little bit later in April, I'm going to be doing some more Earth Matters stuff. Not going to do it in this show, but coming a little bit later in the month for Earth Day, I'll do that. But today, I just thought it was time to remember and celebrate Dr. Jane's good work, that at 90, she is still at it, and that is cause for celebration. Here's my conversation with Dr. Jane Goodall from just a couple of years ago. Enjoy. I appreciate your time. I know you're very, very busy, and I'm just honored to spend a few minutes with you and help you any way that I can with the platform that I have to spread the message that's so very, very important. I hate to keep saying more important than ever, but it seems to be that way.
I know. Hmm. I know it does. Yeah.
So when you look back all the way starting when you were 26 years old, way back in 1960, and you've seen the arc of your work and how it's impacted the world, what are the indicators that you look for that we're having some progress as a species?
Well, there's definitely 100% greater awareness worldwide than there was when I began. But that's because when I began in 1960, we didn't face the problems that we face today. So the forests were not destroyed at that time. There's still the equatorial forest belt stretched across Africa. And, you know, so gradually people have become aware. And the biggest problem is that they become aware of the problems and then they feel helpless to do anything about them, so they do nothing and fall into apathy. That's the big danger.
It really is. I think that the alarm bell has been sounded so many times that people are afraid to answer it and they don't know how and what to do. And I've always been a proponent that you have to do something somewhere. You may not be able to go to, save the rainforest somewhere, but you can do something in your own backyard. And I think people need that reminder quite often. Do you find it, even though you travel the world now, and I don't know how you do it as much as you do it, the people that are responding, are you starting to see the apathy erode a little bit, or is it still an uphill battle?
Well, you know, most of my work when I'm traveling around, other than spreading awareness further, is with young people. And our Roots and Shoots program, which began in 91, is now in well over 50 countries. It's young people, kindergarten, university, and everything in between. And it's based on the fact that every individual makes a difference every single day. And those of us who are fortunate enough not to live in abject poverty, we can choose the kind of difference we're going to make. So, you know, the saying, think globally, act locally. I twist it around because if you think globally, you become helpless with horror of what's going on around the world. But if you act locally, okay, something I'm passionate about, I'm going to clear the beach of litter. I'm going to clean up a river. I'm going to raise money or volunteer at a shelter for dogs or cats. I'm going to raise money for hurricane victims far away. and you roll up your sleeves and you take action. And then you realize that all around the world there are other people like you who care about the same issues, who are also rolling up their sleeves and making a difference. And then you feel supported and strengthened by that feeling that you're not alone.
Yes, I've always said, and I've been doing radio 23, 24 years now, and the content has always lent itself to trying to make sense out of the senseless. Because if you watch the news, none of this makes any sense. But when you pull away from the headlines and you get into the lifelines of people doing incredible work, that's where things could really change. Your work over the years almost has become all-encompassing. It started with the chimpanzees, of course, and shining a light on their plight and their existence. But now it's almost like what Chief Seattle said. Oh, actually, John Muir actually said it better, that if you tug on one thing in nature, you find that it's connected to everything else. Now it's very much all-encompassing. The chimpanzees are almost just a part of the puzzle, aren't they?
Oh, that's absolutely true. And, you know, the fact is that it was 1986 when I'd been studying the chimps since 1960. And we had a conference right here in Chicago, and it was the brainchild of Paul Helmy, who at that time was director of the Academy of Sciences. And we brought together the people who were studying chimps in six different parts of Africa by then. And we had a session on conservation, and it was utterly shocking. I mean, it was a shock for everyone, I think, to see the forest disappearing, the beginning of the bushmeat trade, the commercial hunting of animals for food, including chimps in some countries, shooting of mothers to steal babies for sale as pets or for the international animal trafficking. And we had another session on conditions in some captive situations, like the awful, awful treatment of chimpanzees and other animals in medical research and pharmaceutical research. So I went to the conference as a scientist. I had my PhD by then. I had a research station. The best days of my life out in the rainforest, where you learn about the interconnectedness of everything and the important role that even the tiniest species plays. And I left as an activist. So since then, I haven't been more than 3 weeks in any one place. And that's in twice a year, if I'm lucky.
So then
I felt I had to go to Africa. I needed to learn firsthand more about the plight of the chimps. And learning about the plight of the chimps, I learned about the plight of so many of the people living in and around forest chimpanzee habitat, flying over Gombe, which had been part of that great equatorial forest belt, and seeing below me a tiny island of forest surrounded by completely bare hills, and more people than the land could support, so overused farmland, infertile, steep slopes denuded of trees, terrible soil erosion, streams filtered up, people struggling to survive. And that's when it hit me. If we don't help the people, then there's no way we can even try to save forests and chimpanzees.
For 3 years, I've created and produced a radio program with Bill Curtis, who's a noted conservationist, does A&E, and he's got one of the best voices on radio, so we put him to work. And one of the things that really tried to focus on were the human aspects of this, because it seems that so much of what goes on with conservation, which is a very broad term, is dealing with the effects, not the root cause. And when you get down to the root cause, when it comes down to poaching, for example, there are people trying to simply make money. There's this whole black market thing, and rhinos are my pet animal. I can't even believe eradicate a species because of their horn, which does nothing. You might as well chew on a toenail because it has the same properties. And you see these people that are in difficult circumstances, and as the rise of ecotourism and eco-vacations come up and people make money, there are some changes that happen, but we have a long way to go. So when you're traveling around doing these fundraisers and you've seen the crowds come, what is it I guess what I'm trying to get at is, it's one thing for Jane Goodall to go out and do all this great stuff, but do you think that if the people who are behind the bushmeat trade and the poaching trade, can they be converted into human beings that could make a positive difference as well? Do you think so?
Well, I don't know the people, the gang leaders, because it's now become, it's big business. But what we can do, one, we can boost, we can help raise money so that the rangers on the ground are better equipped to deal with poachers. We can do education programs for the poachers, and yes, we can provide jobs through ecotourism. But the other thing is the demand. So our Roots and Shoots program, the young people, it's in the countries like China and Vietnam and Thailand, where the demand for these rhino horns and elephant tusks and pangolin scales is coming from. So we work on educating them and getting the word out there. Elephants are being killed, rhinos are being killed, and people often, you know, they think it all comes from animals who've died a natural death. There's a huge lack of understanding. So we work on that end, both ends.
It seems to be, and I you know, I'm 60. I feel young, but I'm not young anymore. I still consider myself part of the solution and far less the problem. But it seems to be that you're focusing on the youth, because they're really the ones that have to make the change. I've always thought that unless it's, you know, affects me, then it's somebody else's problem. So it's great to hear about, you know, rhinos and all that kind of stuff. And that's somebody that they would see that in a zoo, but actually doing something about it, that's out of most people's realm of possibility. But young people, what is the response you get when you do your Roots and Shoots program and when you give them this information? How do they respond?
Well, everywhere I've been in all these countries, by the way, we're very strong in China. The young people, once they understand the problem, we listen to them and empower them to act. They're out there making a difference. They're educating their parents and even their grandparents. And you know, so working with the young people, why? Because you hear, we haven't inherited this planet from our parents, we borrowed it from our children. But we haven't borrowed our children's future, we've stolen it. We're still stealing it. And it's time we get together in this little window of chance, little window of time that we have to make a difference. You've got to act together, and we've got to try and harm some of the, you know, heal some of the harm we've inflicted before it's too late, and it will be too late.
The species loss is, you know, record in the history of just our short time as a species on this planet. And whenever I think of that, you know, there's always the deniers of things, and people don't want to admit things. And I always, as you talk about apathy, I think denial follows right behind that. It's a evil twin, which is denial and apathy. And it's just easy to dismiss things, even though there's this unbelievable amount of scientific evidence that all things are connected, and what happens in one place eventually shows up somewhere else. You know, they were monitoring what happened with the Fukushima reactor, and within a certain amount of time, it's already, you know, affecting fish that eventually make it to the, you know, to our shores and all those type of things. And here in the United States, we like to argue about things but do very little as far as solutions. When you come to the United States and when you're doing your fundraisers and you're talking with people, do you see us, are we getting any better on this side of the water, or are we still kind of stuck in our old ways, do you think?
Well, you know, some people are definitely changing, and they tell me so. I know, because the people who come to listen to the lecture, usually around 5,000, sometimes it's a lot more, and the response is making everything worthwhile. You know, people are listening, people are crying, people come up and say, well, I'm going to do my bit now, thank you. Young people are saying, you taught me that because you did it, I can do it too. And so they're newly inspired. And, you know, we're planting trees and organic gardens and fighting the Monsantos. And just really more and more and more people making a difference. We work in about 150,000 active groups of Roots and Shoots. And that the group can be a whole school. And also, we've got all the people who went through Roots and Shoots in school, like Chinese people come up and say, of course we care about the environment. We were in Roots and Shoots in primary school. So it is a changing attitude, but whether it's changing quick enough, that's the burning question.
One of the most difficult things as a broadcaster, as a journalist, as someone who's written about this subject, and I've spoken about this for many years, is getting people to see that they are really connected to the planet. that if you don't think you're connected to the planet, just hold your breath for a few minutes and see what happens. You know, I mean, we are inextricably, we are just residents here. We're not the landlords. You know, we don't own this place. We're just passing through. And getting people off the headlines, as I said, and getting them out into the yard and out into the communities and planting trees and doing these things, I've seen a marked difference even since 1970 from the first Earth Day. But I've also seen a greater pushback than I ever thought was possible from politics, from politicians, from the government, and those type of things. However, saying that, I think there's a gap in there somewhere that then the responsibility comes to we the people, that we shouldn't be, if the Environmental Protection Agency is not doing their job or they've been cut back or whatever the latest and unfortunately greatest scandal is with the EPA, that's a call to action for us as residents of our country here in the United States to actually do something. You've had to put up a lot of political stuff. I'm not going to say the word that I would use for normal people, but you've had to put up with a lot of politics. And how have you worked your way through some really difficult times with that?
Well, what we try to do is say, you know, you can't actually fight those people in powerful positions. Certainly can't in China, you can't in Africa. And at least you're allowed to speak your mind here in the U.S., which is something. If we can't actually fight them, or we'll get, you know, disappeared or closed down or something, you have to work around them. And that's why working with the youth. So get enough young people, get to a tipping point. And when the dictators and the deniers finally age and disappear, then the young people coming up will have the right ethic and the right attitude. But that's why I say, I don't know if we've got time.
Mm. You sound cautiously optimistic. You've used that word time 6 times in this conversation. Do you think that most people, is it because you travel so much that your urgency is there? Because most of us don't. We're all distracted with the news and TV and all that other stuff. Have your travels given you a different sense of urgency over the last few years?
A different sense of urgency, but also a different sense of hope. As you said earlier, there's so many incredible people and amazing projects. And the trouble is, the news is nearly always about doom and gloom. And doom and gloom turns people off. So, you know, I try and share the positive stories, the hopeful stories, the indomitable human spirit, the people who tackle what seems impossible and won't give up, the amazing brain that's beginning to come up with new solutions to let us live in greater harmony with the planet. And you know, the social media, which, yes, it can go wrong, we all know that, but it enables us to reach out in a way never possible before, to bring together people from around the world who care about a single issue and, you know, strengthen each other. So these are the things that give me hope and keep me going. The response to my talks in every country I've been in, you know, every single lecture is sold out. And people clearly want hope.
I've always said when you squeeze oranges, you get orange juice, and when you squeeze tomatoes, you get tomato juice, and when you squeeze humans, all kind of you-know-what comes out. And I think we are being squeezed as a species in ways we've never been squeezed before. So after all these years of work and traveling the world, what is the big takeaway? What is the big aha for you after all this time?
Well, I think it's very, very important to understand that although chimpanzees and other animals are way more intelligent than we used to think, chimpanzees share 98.6% of our DNA composition. Now, they're our closest living relatives. They communicate in ways that we understand, kissing, embracing, holding hands, patting one another. They have a dark and brutal side, but also a loving, compassionate side. And so, yes, we're so like them, but we're different. I think the main difference is the explosive development of our intellect. Quite clearly, we're the most intellectual species that's ever walked on this planet. And yet, we're destroying our only home. You know, we sent a rocket to Mars. Little robots been taking photos. We've seen those photos. We don't want to go and live on Mars. And we only have planet Earth. So how come we're destroying it? but I think there's been a disconnect between our clever, clever brain and our human heart, that's love and compassion. And we've fallen in the West anyway, and unfortunately it's spread around the world into the materialistic society. We've lost touch with nature. And always when there's an economic development like building a dam or a rapid transit or something like that, an environmentalist stand up and say, but you're going to destroy this unique piece of environment. But almost always, not always, but almost always, the developers that win and the environment is destroyed, that part of it. And so, you know, it's because we've sort of begun to worship money. We've lost touch with reality. And instead of thinking about future generations, we're doing things for us now or for the next political campaign or for the next shareholders meeting, instead of thinking about the consequences for the next generation, for the future of the planet. And we're forgetting that without the environment, that's the end of us. The forests give us clean air and water and absorb CO2, and they give out oxygen. The ocean's the same. We're polluting the ocean. We're destroying the forest. And the world's in a mess. But there is hope if we get together now for the reasons that I've already said. I won't give up. And luckily, there are many other people out there fighting for the same cause. There are hundreds and hundreds of small victories. And bringing it all together, then, you know, we have to make change. There's nothing else for it. We have to change.
From the mountains, that one river is all rivers, all rivers are that one. There is a tree that stands in the forest. That one tree is all forest, all trees are that one. There's a flower that blooms in the desert. That one blossom is all flowers, all flowers are that one. There is a bird that sings in the jungle. That one song is all music, all songs are that one. It is a song of life, it is a flower of faith, it is a tree of temptation, it is a river of no regret. There is a child that cries in the ghetto. that shines in the darkness. That one vision is all of our dreams. All of our dreams are that one. It is a vision of heaven. It is a child of promise. It is a dream.